Greetings and hypomacular transitions, my negatropically exonerated listeners. And welcome to the September 2017 Science News Update. I'm your host for this exasperatingly supercutaneous science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Let's just get right on to one of the most amazing pieces of science I've ever heard. You may remember last month I spoke about some scientists at Harvard Med School who had been able to encode a short movie into the genome of a bacteria. The idea was that cells could be used someday as microscopic recording devices of physiological events. Now that blew me away. But the related story I'm going to tell you this evening is brain-meltingly amazing. Computer hackers have been able to insert a virus into a DNA sequence. Okay, when I read that, you probably go, yeah, so nature does that all the time. Retroviruses like herpes and even HIV insert their genetic code into DNA of the host, so what? Well, this article is not quite what you would think it is. You see, computer hackers have put a computer virus into the genome of an organism. And again, you're probably going, what? First, how is that even possible? Second, why would you do that? And third, big deal. How could that possibly hurt anybody, right? It's a computer virus. What does it matter if you stick it in a cell? What could it possibly do if it's not in a computer? Well, that's the amazing thing about this story, and it just shows how incredibly naive I am. I would never have even considered something as wacky as I'm about to tell you. So DNA is fundamentally a way of storing information. I mean, usually it encodes instructions for, well, making living things. But it can be taken over for other purposes. As we've already discussed, scientists have used DNA to store information like books, recordings, GIFs. And now for the first time, researchers from the University of Washington have managed to take over a computer by encoding a malicious program into DNA. Just think about the implications of that. The most frightening thing is just how simple it was. If you remember, strands of DNA are made from four building blocks, represented by the letters A, C, G, and T. And these letters can be used to represent ones and zeros of a computer program. And that's just what the Washington team did. They converted a piece of malware into physical DNA strands. When those strands were sequenced, the malware launched and compromised the computer that was analyzing the sequences, allowing the team to take control of it. Dr. Tadayoshi Kono, who led the research team, said, quote, "The present-day threat is very small, and people don't need to lose sleep immediately, but we wanted to know what was possible and what the issues are down the line," unquote. Kono's worried that this will become a serious threat in the future, and he has reason to be worried. Sequencing was once pretty rare and expensive. I mean, in the early 2000s, it cost about $100 million to sequence a single human genome. And now it's not really that rare or expensive. Now you can have your genome sequenced for less than $1,000. The technology is not just cheaper, but it's also simpler and more portable. There are even pocket-sized sequencers that allow people to analyze DNA in, well, space stations, classrooms, the middle of the jungle, wherever. And for those of you who are CSI fans, what would happen if a sequencer could be easily hacked? Think about it. DNA is, well, it's used in forensics all the time. So if troublemakers could hack sequencing machines or software, they could change the course of an investigation by altering genetic data. Or, if machines are processing confidential data about genetically modified organisms, hackers could steal that intellectual property. With the right molecular malware, it could be possible for adversaries to compromise programs and the computers that run them. I mean, it sounds like the basis of a new Neal Stephenson novel. Kono also says, quote, "There's also the matter of personal genetic data. The United States is currently trying to sequence the data of at least 1 million Americans to pave the way for precision medicine, where treatments are tailored to an individual's genes. That data is very sensitive. If you compromise the sequencing pipeline, you could steal that data or manipulate it. to make it look like people have diseases they don't actually have. DNA sequencing is an emerging field that other security researchers haven't looked at. So we asked ourselves, could we compromise a computer system with DNA? Unquote. Well, they could and they did. And it wasn't quite as easy as I made it out to be at first. To make their malware work, the team introduced a vulnerability into a program that's commonly used to analyze DNA sequence files. Then they exploited that weakness. Okay, it's a bit of a cheat, but the team also showed that that vulnerability seems to be common in software for analyzing DNA. The people who wrote those programs didn't really have hacking in mind, so their products tend to be rather insecure, and they rarely follow best practices for digital security. Kono finishes with, quote, "My hope is that over the next 5 to 10 years, people take strong interest in DNA security and proactively harden their systems against adversarial threats. We don't know of such threats arising yet, and we hope that they'll never manifest," unquote. Next story. Horses. Why don't they have toes anymore? So horses are pretty amazing creatures. They can leap over high hurdles. They can gallop at, 70 kilometers per hour. They can haul around 1,000 kilos of body weight. And all with just one big toe on each foot. A new study published August 23rd in the Proceedings of the Royal Society B by Dr. Brianna McHorse of Harvard helps to explain why. Yes, I know, seriously, she works on horses and her name is McHorse. I don't know if one preceded the other. Anyway, along with zebras and donkeys, horses are among the few single-toed creatures in the animal kingdom. Scientists have long suspected that horses' single-hoofed toes help them run further and faster over the grasslands, letting them flee predators and find fresh food. But the hypothesis that having one big toe is better than having several, biomechanically speaking, has never really been tested directly. According to the article, and not something I ever actually thought about, ancient horses had a lot of toes to lose. Horses were about the size of a dog 55 million years ago. Hyracotherium had 4 toes on their front feet and 3 on their back feet. 10 million years ago, the horse ancestor Merychippus actually did resemble a modern horse, but it had 3 toes, including 1 long middle digit with a protective toenail-like hoof at the end. Both the genus from 10 and 55 million years ago are now gone. The only surviving horse genus is the single-toed equus that we all know and love, which emerged about 5 million years ago. To retrace the evolution of horse toes, McHorse and colleagues use CT scans to capture the internal structure of fossilized foot bones from 12 kinds of extinct horses. They also analyze the feet of the closely related South American tapir, which are oddly toed, like Hyracotherium. A computer simulation that let researchers estimate how the bones would respond to the stresses of locomotion for each species, like jumping over a hurdle or accelerating. Then the scientists compared what would happen when they applied the animal's full body weight to just the central toe or spread it among multiple toes. Side toes significantly increased the early horse's ability to bear their own weight, the team found. The central toe of the early horses would have fractured without the help of the toes on either side. As the era of modern horses approached and the side toes dropped away, however, the middle toe bone grew thicker and hollower. These changes made the single-toed foot nearly as sturdy as multiple toes. McHorse says, quote, "As horses' legs grew longer, the extra toes at the end of the limb would have been like wearing extra weights around your ankles. Shedding those toes could have helped early horses to save energy, allowing them to travel farther and faster," unquote. Unfortunately, the study can't determine what changes came first, whether bulking up the middle toe drove the loss of the side toes, or the loss of the side toes caused the changes in the middle toe. Next story. So the next story is an update from one that our most loyal listeners may remember from last year around March or April of 2016. I reported a story on some mysterious hypothetical galactic structures that could be alien in origin and actually constructed around a star. I think they were referred to at the time as alien megastructures. Well, apparently further research has suggested that the alien megastructures are probably not there and not the case. The usual fading of an oddball star is more likely caused by either clouds of dust or an abnormal cycle of brightening and dimming, two new papers have suggested, and not alien megastructures. Published in the online journal Archive, Dr. Juan Meng of the University of Arizona in Tucson and his colleagues suggest that KIC 8462852, also known as Tabby's star, is dimming thanks to an orbiting cloud of fine dust particles. The team observed the star with the infrared Spitzer and ultraviolet SWIFT space telescopes from October 2015 to December 2016. The first observations in multiple wavelengths of light, apparently. They found that the star is dimming faster in the short blue wavelengths than the longer red ones, suggesting small particles. Meng says, quote, "Our results almost absolutely ruled out the alien megastructure scenario, unless it's an alien microstructure," unquote. I reported last year that Tabby star is famous for suddenly dropping in brightness up to 22% over the course of a few days. Later observations suggested that the star is also fading by about 4% a year, which Meng's team confirmed in the August 24th paper. Meng suggested that the brightening of Tabby's star could be due to a magnetic cycle like our own sun, but no known cycle makes a star brighten and dim by quite so much, so that star would be very odd. It has previously been suggested that a ripped-up planet falling in pieces into the star could explain both the long-term and the short-term dimming. Meng thinks that that model still may work, although it needs some tweaks. Okay, next story. I think September is turning into update month. 2 months ago, I talked about water bears. Remember tardigrades and their ability to withstand freezing, radiation, etc.? And how we think now that it is because they have a special set of proteins that have a special disordered structure. Well, that's great. It still doesn't answer the question of the source of water bears and evolution. What are they related to? Where do they evolutionarily come from? Where tardigrades belong in the tree of life is not that simple a question, apparently. Some previous work suggests that these tiny animals that can survive intense environmental challenges are most closely related to flatworms like nematodes. And then there's other studies, and the animal's morphology, which points to arthropods, like crabs, as the water bear's nearest relatives. Now, Dr. Mark Blackster of the University of Edinburgh and his team have compared detailed genome assemblies of two tardigrade species in the journal PLOS Biology last month. The article sheds light on water bears' ability to endure punishing circumstances, but it still doesn't quite resolve their evolutionary history. There are about 1,200 species of tardigrades living on land, in fresh water, and in salt water. They're no bigger than a grain of salt and look like chubby, bumbling little bears with four pairs of legs. Blackster says, quote, "Tardigrades are very small, so they're quite hard to work with. The genome is a great way of understanding what's going on inside the organism and also placing that organism in the context of everything else," unquote. Blackster looked closely at the genome of the tardigrade Hypsibius dujarnii. Because previous versions of the animal's genome told conflicting stories, one assembly suggested large amounts of horizontal gene transfer from bacteria and plants and fungi and archaea, while others found no such evidence. He began by sequencing genomic DNA of an individual animal and pool DNA for about 900,000 other tardigrades. He also compared the high-quality Hypsibius dujarnii genome with that of another tardigrade, Romazodius varionatus. He found that the H. dujardini genome was nearly twice the size of the R. varionatus. Their analysis of gene sequences indicated that the tardigrades are most likely related to nematodes, yet an examination of rare genomic changes supported the tardigrade arthropod relationship. The authors also determined that only about 1% of the genes in each genome arrived by horizontal gene transfer, which was much lower than that very high previous estimate. They hypothesized this discrepancy was likely due to contamination with microbial DNA in earlier sequencing. The most compelling open question for Blackster focuses on the phylogeny and the still unclear relationship between tardigrades, nematodes, and arthropods. He finishes up with this, quote, "Understanding them is going to be very useful for sorting out the history of life in this bit of the animal tree. It might seem a bit like bookkeeping, but in fact, if we can sort out these relationships, we've sorted out relationships of most of the animals on the planet." Unquote. Onward and upward. Let's talk about magic mushrooms. What makes them magic, and why study them? Turns out that a basic understanding of magic mushrooms has been around, well, for a while, since the 1950s. After Albert Hofmann first revealed the chemical structure of psilocybin, the psychoactive compound found in psilocybe carpophores, or magic mushrooms, the fungus quickly became associated with the psychedelic counterculture of the 1960s. However, due to legal restrictions and the mushroom's genetic complexities, learning exactly how the fungus synthesizes psilocybin and what pathway it uses has been quite the long scientific trip, so to speak. Now, Dr. Dirk Hofmeister, in the German journal Angewandte Chemie, this month, describes the key fungal enzymes needed to create the hallucinogenic compound, as well as a biosynthetic process for creating psilocybin on demand. These findings may enable more cost-effective production of the compound, allowing researchers to more deeply explore its therapeutic potential. Hofmeister says, quote, "Here we have simply solved a little miracle of how Mother Nature naturally uses certain enzymes to make a fantastic compound that has been impacting humankind for centuries. I believe this can trigger an important discussion on the pharmaceutical value of psilocybin and bring it back into the spotlight, instead of dismissed as a flower-powered drug that was popular decades ago." Unquote. To understand how mushrooms synthesize psilocybin, Hofmeister's team sequenced the genome of two fungi, psilocybe cubensis and psilocybe sinensis. And then they computationally identified key genes and encode four distinct enzymes used to convert the amino acid L-tryptophan into psilocybin. The researchers next cloned the genes and produced the enzymes in bacterial and fungal cultures, verifying each step of the enzyme's activity in synthesizing psilocybin. I love this idea of transferring an entire pathway that generates an illegal drug into a different organism, because I proposed it about 10 years ago in my novel, The Standards of Creation. Mind you, I proposed employing the coca pathway and not the psilocybin one, but the idea still thrills me of regenerating an entire pathway in a new organism. My novel, by the way, is still available on uvulaaudio.com if anyone is interested. That's uvulaaudio.com. Well, enough of this self-serving stuff. Hofmeister's team found that they could produce their own samples of psilocybin in the lab by creating a combined reaction using just three out of the four fungal enzymes. Hofmeister says, quote, "We knew what enzymatic activity to look for, but we were pretty surprised to see how smoothly the process worked in vitro once we combined the enzymes." Unquote. probably because it went so smoothly, Hofmeister finishes quite enthusiastically with, quote, "We believe that this discovery could open the doors for more efficient commercial production of psilocybin for pharmaceutical and therapeutic use. At the moment, psilocybin is a Schedule I narcotic and shares a similar story with hemp, which is also looked on unfavorably. Previous clinical trials have shown real therapeutic benefit for psilocybin, and by providing the route of how to access the molecule, perhaps this should put it back on the radar for patients in future clinical trials or academic research." Unquote. The final story of the night concerns fat, something I am closely familiar with. It seems that unless I eat a diet that consists of either air or just meat, I gain weight. When I eat carbohydrates in very reasonable quantities without binge eating, I gain weight. I'm still quite healthy despite being overweight because I walk several miles a day and continue my martial arts regime. But the fat is obviously annoying and may one day actually cause me health issues if it continues to stay around. Some would argue that my overweight does cause a health issue because it is probably the most immediate cause of my sleep apnea. But let's not go there, ladies and germs. Well, what if I told you that some researchers may actually have a practical way to get rid of belly fat? You would think I sound like a 2 a.m. infomercial, but I am quite serious, and this group's work is quite promising, actually. Dr. Zhen Gu from the University of North Carolina and his collaborators have developed a medicated skin patch that can melt away fat, increase metabolism, and potentially even help to treat metabolic disorders like type 2 diabetes. The prototype postage-sized microneedle patch was developed by the researchers at the University of North Carolina, and it comprises dozens of degradable microneedles that painlessly pierce the skin to deliver nanoparticle-encapsulated drugs that convert energy-storing white fat into energy-burning brown fat, and they effectively burn off fat deposits. This work was reported this month in the journal ACS Nano, and the paper was entitled "Locally Induced Adipose Tissue Browning by Microneedle Patch for Obesity Treatment." Gu says, quote, "Many people will no doubt be excited to learn that we may be able to offer a non-invasive alternative to liposuction for reducing love handles. What's more important is that our patch may provide a safe and effective means of treating obesity and related metabolic disorders like diabetes." Unquote. The entire approach is based on the fact that mammals have two types of fat. Brown adipose tissue burns fat to generate heat, whereas white adipose tissue stores energy in the form of fat droplets. Adult humans have a predominance of white fat. According to the paper, drugs are available that can promote the conversion of white fat into brown fat, a process termed browning. Ew. But these drugs cause side effects. Additionally, all these drugs have to be given as pills or injections in the long term. This exposes the whole body to the drugs. Of course, if you expose the whole body to drugs, that can lead to side effects like upset stomachs, weight gain, oddly enough, and bone fractures. Gu and his group developed the degradable microneedle patch as an alternative treatment that enables localized painless drug administration. The patches were loaded with one of two nanoparticle formulations of drugs known to promote browning, the diabetes drug Avandia and a beta-adrenergic receptor agonist CL316243, which is active in mice, but not in humans. And it has a different mechanism of action, apparently, than it would in humans. Yes, kind listeners, again, don't get too excited about the entire story. Gu and company have not yet prepared patches that may work in humans, and they don't even know whether this will work in humans yet. It will be cool if it does, but still, not quite yet. Gu says, quote, "The nanoparticles were designed to effectively hold the drug and then gradually collapse releasing it into nearby tissue in a sustained way, instead of spreading the drug throughout the body quickly, unquote. The team first tested the patches on normal lean mice to confirm sustained drug release. An analysis of fat tissues under the patches indicated shrinkage of the white fat cells and the appearance of the beige fat cells. Gene analysis supported the browning transformation of the white fat, and there was an upregulation of brown fat genes. Treated mice also lost weight due to reduced fat mass and showed a 20% increase in oxygen consumption, which is a measure of metabolic activity. They then applied the patches to the skin of obese mice. A fresh, drug-loaded patch was placed on one side of the lower abdomen of each test mouse every 3 days for 4 weeks. The results confirmed that both types of patch halted weight gain, which the authors say was surprising, for the drugs that they used usually can cause weight gain, not weight loss. Patch therapy also led to about a 30% reduction in the white fat tissue and a 20% reduction in fat pat size and an upregulation of brown fat genes on the treated side. Gu concludes with, quote, "Our in vivo data further demonstrated a systemic increase of energy expenditure and fatty acid oxidation, effective body weight control in diet-induced mice, as well as improved insulin sensitivity. Taken together, our work provides a new strategy in applying drugs through microneedles as potential therapeutics for the clinical treatment of obesity and its comorbidities, such as type 2 diabetes," unquote. Something tells me that the patent to Goo's microneedle injection system is going to be worth a boatload of money. Just a guess, mind you. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. Watch your weight until those patches are commercialized. Watch for computer viruses in your DNA. Keep watching the skies. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.